Welcome to By the Sword, where we discuss the modern study of historical European martial arts, or HEMA, with instructors, experts, and martial artists from all over the world. In this episode, I speak to historians Yasin Tsouriadis and Elizabeth Champion. We discuss the exciting rediscovery of Joachim Meyer's fencing manuscript of 1561. The episode was recorded on the 11th of June, 2021. Hi everyone, welcome to this special edition of By the Sword, where I'm speaking to two historians who also happen to be historical fencers. So my guests today are Elizabeth Champion and Yasin Tsouriadis. So I'll pass to you, Elizabeth, if you just tell us about yourself.
Right, hi, yep. So my name's Elizabeth Champion. I'm currently completing my Master's in Medieval History at the University of Leeds at the moment, and I specialise in Merlin and the Late Medieval Tournament. And I am so pumped to be talking about Meyer. You have no idea. I'm so excited. Let's go.
And Yasin.
Hello, I'm Yasin. I am the online content editor for the Martial Culture in Medieval Towns Research Project hosted by the University of Bern. I'm an arms and armor scholar with a particular interest in the medieval tournament and staff weapons, I guess. I am a fan of Joachim Meyer, but there are people far more experienced in the matter than I am. But I am ready to be fanboying over the subject. So thank you for that.
Yes, so we're all three of us here to fanboy about something that we have a passing interest in. We're not huge Meyerists here, any of us. But the HEMA community, the historical fencing community, has been abuzz over the last week or so over this article that came out in Acta Periodica Duellatorum, the free journal that's available for historical fencing community. And this article written by Olivier Dupuis, where there's been a discovery, his discovery of a manuscript by Joachim Meyer written in 1561. So, Elizabeth, you can begin the squee.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Right. Everyone cover your ears. No, I'm kidding. I am so excited about this. I'm afraid I'm more of a theorist. I know, boo, et cetera, but I'm so excited to be talking about this today. I actually found out about this through Jacob Deacon, who did an amazing, he took this all apart and put it in sort of more layman's terms on his Twitter, which is DeaconJH. It's really good. I'd highly recommend having a look at it before reading Dupuis' article, which is also just brilliant. It gives such a wonderful overview of who Meyer is and why this is important and why it's a rediscovery and not a discovery. So I can't wait to talk about that a bit more.
And Yasin, how did you feel when the news broke?
I mean, it's not every day that we get a new manuscript, especially of this sort of dearth, really, to that discusses like that amount of subjects in regards to European martial arts. Even more so, especially when it relates to such a popular author such as Joachim Meyer. I would just simply repeat being like the stereotypical commentator, I'm just going to promote my friend here, Jacob Deacon. Please go and follow him on Twitter. He's one of the editors of the Acta Periodica Duellatorum, the online free academic journal that hosted the article by Olivier Dupuis. And Jacob occasionally tweets about very interesting stuff in related to history and European martial arts. He's also somebody who does his PhD on English fencing masters. But anyway, in regards to the manuscript itself, I couldn't believe the fact that, you know, like Joachim Meyer's printed book is one of the most impressive books that the HEMA-verse, you know, fetishizes. And finding like a manuscript that looks, that is at least on par aesthetically, it's impressive just on its own. And then, of course, you have the depth of information, but I assume that Fran would like to talk about this later.
Yeah, we can come on to that. And, of course, our friend Jacob, let's just remind us what his Twitter handle is.
It's Deacon JH.
Deacon JH. So Jacob is, as we say, an editor at a periodica Duellatorum, and has a real... really good insight. We should have invited him on the show, really.
I know, we should. He's gonna, he's gonna be fuming, but
we'll get him next time.
The journal is amazing. I'd highly recommend. It's not people sort of, even if you're a humorist who does more for the sport, still definitely check this out. It is written so well. Everything is so understandable on there. It's definitely worth checking them out.
It's very accessible and
digestible.
And it's fun to sort of read and get into and learn more about, you know, the period and the people that wrote the books.
Absolutely.
So Olivia Dupuy has written this article. It's got social media, HEMA world aflame. And something that we were just talking about now was how quickly people are starting to interpret and... you know, put their sort of spin on things. And I want to know, Elizabeth, how do you take, you know, what do you think is a reasonable amount of time from finding out there's a brand new book to taking
digesting? It's so exciting when things like this happen because, you know, we all like to think our lives are a bit like Indiana Jones or The Mummy, where it's like, oh, we've rediscovered this amazing manuscript and it means all of this. And in reality, it's usually much more boring than that. So it's been lovely to see the humor side of everyone get really excited because I've been talking to my family about it and they've gone, oh, that's nice. It's like, no, you don't understand. but actually for this, I'd actually like to pass over to Yasin for this because when we were having a conversation about this, I think he worded it in a very good way. So I'd like to actually pass over to him for this, I think.
Take the mic, Yasin.
Yeah.
Did you mean he rages about it? Like,
rage.
Being polite. So let's all bring it down.
He's got a take.
a take, yes.
Like the amount of days, the amount of time, 3,782 days, probably. Yeah, that's
so nothing specific, just a general ballpark.
Yeah. it's quite weird. Frankly, like my feed now on all of my social media is like Mega keeps popping up so often that I'm sick of it a little bit, I'll be honest. I am. I do like the illustrations and all that, as well as the content, of course. Mm-hmm. However, I cannot say that I have sat down to study it myself to even have a proper. I've only done like a read through to see what the content is, roughly. I think the public awareness of it within the Hemaverse. It's very it has a very dual nature that is both a curse and a blessing in a sense. So you have a lot of people that are untrained amateurs, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing, because it's such a niche subject that we need the untrained, amateurs. And if we didn't have those people putting the time and effort, and we only expected from academics to do this, probably a lot of these manuscripts and books would have not have had, you know, the moment in the sun this far.
I agree.
On another note, I've already seen online, and that's what both Elizabeth and Fran are referring to when I raged about it earlier, was I already see people online putting on transcriptions or translations and already people posting videos with interpretations.
Yeah.
So the matter of studying the whole genre of fight books, right, and its purpose as a whole, it's a whole different discussion. And if you can replicate emotions and how well you can do it and that kind of, that's a whole different discussion. But let's say for the sake of it, that we're aiming to a good interpretation that is martially sound and all that. I feel that anything produced so quickly is more like done out of a hype, sometimes enthusiasm as well, rather than being obviously the meticulous work of a lifetime that such a work would take to produce an interpretation of. Because we're talking about like even a simple page of it, it's really, really dense. It's exciting because we have all the information about, well, we have little information about the author and about this manuscript in particular, and people are just seem to be jumping the gun and I know that, you know, like a good translation might come by people collaborating, people getting ideas and all that. I simply think that as Dirk Hagedorn posted on Facebook a few days ago, just be patient. A translation and transcription are coming out by people who've done some linguistic analysis.
It's a bit like George R. R. Martin, you know, waiting for one of his novels to come out, and in the meantime, people are writing all these fanfics.
Yeah, do you know what? That's like quite a good way of characterizing it. I think as historians, we feel that we need to jump on the hype that the public are currently giving us and get them as much information as possible to keep this interest going. Because to us as academics, it will remain interesting for the next year, 2 years, 3 years. That to us is still very, very new. But by that time, the public might have moved on. Yeah. So we need, on the one hand, we're trying to capitalize on this excitement as historians. So there's a panic there to try and get that, keep that attention going. But, and it sounds uncharitable and perhaps gatekeeping, but when these translations come out so quickly, it actually hinders our progress. If only on a commercial standpoint, publishers might pick up a translation too early, and then it means more accurate translation would not be published. So that actually can hinder our progress. And then on the other side of it, you've got accounts that have these amazing, we love the fact that humor is becoming more mainstream, who are jumping on these interpretations and not clarifying that actually they're just having a play around and this isn't a solid thing yet. But then people take that and run with it, and then it all becomes very convoluted, and we have to do a lot of unpicking to sort of get back to this. So as much as amazing it is that people are wanting to get involved, there is an element that, you know, we as a community have to agree to slow down. And if one of us jumps the gun a bit too early, it's a bit like mutually assured destruction. If one of us jumps the gun a bit too early, everyone's going to rush, and that's just not what we want at all.
Yeah.
I mean, at one end, you've got 500 years ago, whatever, someone's got a distillation of their complete knowledge of fencing on the page in another language from another time. Mm-hmm. And to think that you can just unpick that in a couple of weeks I've got it now at the other end through
it devalues
time and distance, you know, it's a bit much.
Exactly. I mean, and it devalues the years of training that people put in order to do this. If we make it look like it is easy, it's certainly not. And they put so much time into this to get it right. Sorry, Yasin, I interrupted.
No, I did. Sorry, I apologize. I just want to say, like, yeah, it, for me, it's interesting. When I hear people trying to teach and produce interpretations of all these different sources, I find it really weird, right? So, of course, there's a whole discussion if HEMA has martial systems in it or not, and what constitutes a system and all that. In my opinion, they appear much later than what people would like to, at least in a form that can be discernible. But then I just find peculiar when people try to demonstrate expertise on various, I'm putting like inverted commas here in the air, systems. Like, I think it takes a lifetime to even like reach some form of understanding in one of them.
Yes.
And then suddenly I have seen people who go in and teach workshops. They'll do, you know, like Marozzo one day, Meyer the other, and some Hutton the third. Like, you know, just pick one and just give an informed opinion.
I mean, there is a lifetime's work in one master's publishers. A lifetime. You're like, you could just dig into that forever and ever and revise your understanding continually, which is what many HEMA clubs do. They're like, oh, we've always used to do this technique like this, but now we've got some insight through practical application, we now know that it means this, or at least that's our current interpretation. You know, it's not set in stone like the books. It's, you know, it is always going to be an understanding, and understandings change the more information you gather. I think, yeah, it is a bit like you say, jumping to assume that you've, oh, I've got it now. You know, people often say, if you're going to write something, if you're going to write, whether it's fiction or if it's research or whatever it is, don't tell anyone until it's done.
If I'm honest with any humor interpretation, if anyone really says, oh, I've got it now, I don't care what it is.
Warning, alarm bells.
Yeah. It's to me, that's an anathema on its own. You know, like it's exactly, it's an indication that somebody is more like full on themselves rather than.
But on the other hand, though, without, like you say, we don't want to sound too gatekeepery. No, the fact that we do have this mass of labour is wonderful. Yes. And the fact that people are willing and only too eager to try stuff out is great.
It's wonderful, because we're very lucky as a field in that we have people coming at it from so many different angles. I personally come at it, well, actually, I was introduced to it through more the sports side, but I've found that the academic side interests me a bit more. We have people that are a bit 50-50. There are some who are really good at sports and understand a lot about body mechanics, who can tell us a lot of stuff we as academics, you know, all of us, in, we're not exactly all big, beefy people reading books, are we? So we don't understand the human body as well as an actual sports person might. So it helps to have those perspectives coming in. So we definitely don't want to imply that these people shouldn't be getting involved. Of course you should, but speak to the people who are currently working on it and say, just message them or email them, say, oh, hey, I've had an idea, as opposed to independently published. I think that's sort of what we're trying to get at. Definitely give us your ideas, but give them to the people who are currently heading the research, who can then filter that through their years of training and perhaps get somewhere with it.
Collaboration.
Exactly.
Collaboration, not competition.
Exactly.
You can have like on the other side of that spectrum, you can have like academics who act negatively on the subject, who might take ages. I know, unfortunately, of a few manuscripts that have been, again, inverted commas, have been discovered, nothing as major as this, but they do not get published because the academics who discover them are sitting on them. And I'm thinking about I know about somebody who's sitting on something like this for like 15 years now.
But that's the thing, what we're talking about here is not in any term of things. This is not a long period of time. This has been like announced a week ago or 2 weeks ago or something. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason that the people who are researching it, when they found it, didn't talk about it immediately, because they wanted to compile some information to give to the public on top of this news discovery. So they've sat on it a little bit. And we're not asking for people to, you know, if there's something that's been sat on for 15 years, by all means, start to, you know, say, hey, let's get some work going on this. It's the etiquette within academia is give them a bit of time to get their ideas out, and if they're taking absolutely ages, of course start to get a bit more involved.
Well, hey, you know like in Facebook time, like a week is like enough for you to get a divorce over it, right? It's like
well, to be honest, like when we came on and I was like, oh, I want to get you two on the podcast, I was like, I want to do it now.
But then the problem is we responded with, yeah, let's do it, and then we were all like, calm down, let's take notes.
And so circumstances have pushed us back several days to calm us down a bit. So we are victim to that mentality ourselves. Now that we've raged a bit, let's talk about the book itself and how it, because it's not it's not like a hidden lost book, like Gigante's second book that was never thought to have been written. It was known about, wasn't it? So it's a rediscovery. Absolutely. Let's talk about how that happened.
Absolutely. So this is, as you say, Fran, it is a rediscovery. It's not quite as exciting as a big discovery. And it's a bit embarrassing as historians to sort of admit that it's a rediscovery because we lost it. So it's not even, I was speaking to both Fran and Yasin about this recently and saying how much I back human beings being involved in cataloguing, archiving, because you need humans to see these connections. And if you leave it all down to a computer, things can get lost. So in this instance, Dupuy actually unpacks this really, really well in his article. And he explains that its last mention in a museum catalogue was in 1887. Then after that, it was on display, and then it seems to have moved. And then we sort of lost it a bit. And I think one of the theories is that it was theory that Dupuy puts forward is that it was put under Paulus Hechtermeyer's name, who was a collector as opposed to any writer, which is an easy mistake to make. Paulus Hechtermeyer's last name is spelt M-A-I-R and Mayer M-E-Y-E-R. Mm. And it's not uncommon for people to write their names slightly differently, or for copies of things to happen and people to write names slightly differently. We do see this happening. So it's not as silly as a mistake as it might seem. But no, it's definitely a read. Unfortunately, so it's not like once you've discovered it, that's it, and the history is done. No. These things are continually moving through museums and things, and we can occasionally, unfortunately, lose things.
Lose them, yeah. Keeping track of stuff is part of the job. Moving targets, kind of thing. Mm. So let's just talk about. How it was published, the sort of circumstances. Let's talk about because he obviously had his fight book from 1570, which is famous throughout the HEMA movement. It's very comprehensive. How does this work, this earlier work from 1561, how does that change our understanding or our view of his fight book? And what are the sort of circumstances in which he was living and which this book was written? Yasin?
Too many things to unpack there.
Too many things! One of those things, I said.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention that, you know, like, Paulus Hechtermeyer, by the way, did have a fight book, like a 2-volume one. Simply didn't read it.
Oh, no, he did, yes, of course.
He commissioned it because he was a huge nerd. And, you know,
yes.
He's a passive patron saint of all of us because he spent too much money on swords.
No, you're absolutely right.
And partying and swords. Anyway. but in regards to his book, I think the manuscript is one of the reasons that it excites me, probably, and a few more people, not just me, is that that is most likely, like, you know, the personal copy. This is like the master book on which he based his later fight book. So that's the initial compilation. So I have seen people highlighting some of the pages on this, because there are pages that do not exist in the printed book that include some theories. Unfortunately, not much. But even being able to follow this process, it's invaluable. In regards now to how and when it is produced, would you like me to talk more about Mayer?
Well, let's talk about Mayer the Man. That was going to be my next thing, but I'm just looking for the ever-present context that we're always sort of trying to refer things back to make them make sense. So Mayer the Man, he was fairly young when he published.
Yeah,
was he not?
So there's it's fairly uncertain how old he was. There's very little, like, for somebody who wrote something so important, right? Mm. But that same problem, mind you, we have with nearly all authors before him, or five books as well, is that we have very little information about his life. Mm. There has been work done on this by Olivier Dupuy, Roger Norling, various people. And in fact, Olivier organized a conference just on Joachim Mayer in the beginning of 2020. And then, you know, that weird virus thing happened.
Oh, that!
But the proceedings of that will be published soon as well. I think on APD. So there's more information about Mayer and his background. Now, if there are some stipulations in regards to where he was from, how old he was, and if the most common attribution is correct, when he produced this new manuscript, he was 24.
Yeah.
Yeah, usually, like when I look back at me being 24, I was just starting a PhD and I was usually hungover.
I am 24 and I am hungover, so yes, I can completely Yeah.
Where's the manuscript?
Stop asking me this. I've told you it will be
next year. Yeah.
Next year.
But yeah, it's quite interesting because we're talking about somebody who moved to Strasbourg, and who was clearly a burger because and he married a burger's widow.
Sorry, clarify for the listeners what a burger is.
So somebody with citizen rights in cities, in specific geographical areas in the late Middle Ages and early modern period. He got the rights to be a cutler, so to participate in the cutler's guild through his wife, who was the widow of a previous cutler, and of course, to get in a guild that will happen either via patrimony or through other such legal manners. I find fascinating the fact that he was a member of a guild with an actual profession, and he was still being able to produce this manuscript and later the book. And then there's research on his other deeds in the period between these two things, where he organized competitions and fencing seminars, fechulen and all that. So I just find fascinating. I had a very condensed life, and he managed to balance being probably balanced, you know,
yeah,
balanced to being able to be like a fencing master as well as a cutler.
I think it's amazing to think that the parallels between HEMA instructors now and this guy. Yeah. You know, you've got a day job, you're teaching people how to fence, you're writing books. And you've got to organize events as well, and that's what train so students. It's very, very similar.
But I think that's what's so it speaks a lot to how we receive history as sort of people in this, like people now looking back, we think, oh, they must have been these amazing people and they must have done all of this. And no, people have never changed throughout history. You will always need to make money. Yeah. Things like this will probably never really make that much money, even in societies that do value these skills. You know, having more than one job is quite a common thing. So I think it's easy for us to look back and go and really sort of put these people on a pedestal and say, oh, they clearly did this and they devoted. No, they've got to make money like the rest of us, and they've got to have side gigs like the rest of us. It just, their side gigs might be a bit more successful.
His side hustle, you know.
Or you become a public servant, you embezzle a lot of money, and you're having a blast and they hang you for it. That's Paulus Jachtermeer.
No, that's
party. It took me a few years, like being able to tell each other apart, I'll be honest. You know, both impressive books and all that. And now, unfortunately, both colourful books are amazing.
Yeah.
I do think that he produced his book at a very, his manuscript rather, at a very interesting time. It's a period where the medium of fine books changes. Like we have all these manuscripts that are personal copies, not personal copies, but rather produced for specific people in the 15th yeah. century. And then you go into printed fine books in the 16th century.
So mass produced.
Oh yeah, exactly. And then in Meyer until now was only part of the latter, where now you actually have something like this. Can you imagine we found something like this about Marot or anyone really with a printed fine book?
Mm.
Finding like something that has the person's notes or an early draft. I think it's quite interesting in that regard.
Do you think, like Dupuis mentions this in his article about the aristocracy being the keepers of, you know, the fighting arts in the sort of 15th century, and then as mass-produced fight books appear, and you have like the sort of bourgeoisie of which we can say that Meyer was a member of. He was not a noble. He wasn't an aristocrat. He was working. He probably had a patron who was an aristocrat. Do you think that the kind of something that he alludes to was that the sort of middle class, which was springing up aided, I guess, by the proliferation of printed works and things like this, and the printed word, were becoming, you know, the fighting arts was becoming more of a middle class pastime, sort of a social activity, with the aim to teach the citizens how to fight if they needed to. Hello?
Hello.
Oh, am I just talking to the wind?
No.
Oh, no, we're here.
What do you want to take the question?
I think the question better go to Yasin, to be honest, because our discussion of it, you worded it very... We had a discussion about this, and I thought you worded it quite well and concisely.
I went into a bit of a cul-de-sac with that one. But, I mean, what I'm trying to say is, was Maya part of a middle-class, growing middle-class of people who were learning how to do fighting as a sort of social activity?
I think that, you know, like the fact that you have printed fight books on its own, right? It's a testament to the growing popularity of learning how to fight for a wider audience. Now, mind you, that's already from the middle of the 15th century. If it makes sense, like fight books, sorry to go back to it, fight books, print fight books are a symptom of social changes in large European centres of the period, already from the middle of the 15th century. You have a change in the way that a war is conducted, where you start having like the first actual professional armies, not mercenary armies, standing professional armies.
Right.
The second thing is that these books were originally produced for the martial elite, people with money, power, titles, and so on.
Right.
With a growing popularity of with a constant wars and conflicts of the 15th and early 16th centuries, I think martial skills become something more apparent in society, and then you have and also commerce and technology both confluence towards the creation of what would be the equivalent of what you said, like essentially a middle class. It's not precisely that, but it's roughly an equivalent of that.
Yeah.
And suddenly these get an interest in communicating and learning skills that were previously only aimed towards the martial elite. Mm-hmm. I do not think that the main reason for fighting is driven by the necessity, you know, like of a violent society learning to know how to fight. I think that those that needed to fight would learn how to fight regardless. Mm-hmm. But more people start learning to fence in. I don't want to say like a hobby, but more like an activity. As a leisure, yes, thank you. Yeah. Exactly in the same manner that you'd start having competitions on things like shooting.
Mm-hmm. Or HEMA.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's HEMA before HEMA.
Yeah.
In a sense. and when you start seeing works, and I love this, when people start discussing 15th century fight books, as if they were books that prepared you for a duel, I would dare anyone to learn how to do karate from a karate book, and they were very popular in the 80s, or learn how to dance foxtrot from a book about foxtrot, and there's also plenty. I think that people want these books, want the activity, because it's something that looks cool. Probably back then, it adds certain prestige to the people communicating these skills as well. Mm-hmm. I think that, and as that changes, you have big social changes that make swords being more accessible to more people as well, because it's easy to produce them, or rather cheaper. And they become an accessory. So, you reach the 18th century, or like already from the 17th century, the sword is a gentleman's part of someone's attire.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's like, I think it's interesting when looking at these books, and And, you know, there's this whole debate over book versus manual, and they're really, they're not manuals, because you couldn't possibly learn from them. There's no secret. It's not that all the people that had these books had a secret and could learn from it, and you just can't because you're an idiot and just can't work out how it works. Now, yes, they'll have had more training, so there are certain shorthands and things that you can refer to, but it wouldn't have been quite that opaque. It's like, you don't have cookery books being made on how to cook. You have on how to cook French food, how to cook this particular with this ingredient, not how to cook as a baseline. So I think that's a really good point. They're not necessarily there to teach people how to fight, because they're very particular and they're not that easy to learn from. I think we can all speak from experience there.
What we need is a HEMA version of Delia Smith.
Yes.
Like someone who'll teach you how to cook.
I've been saying this for years. Yes.
But as we were saying last time, swords are cool.
I said you can quote me on it. I said swords are cool. Be cool. And they've never not been cool. They're just cool things. And I think a great way to convey to the public when they say, oh, why would you want that? Or why do you want a sword that looks like this? Don't you think it looks cool? Well, yeah, but yeah, then it's cool. There's not like a secret code on it. It's just that flowers on a sword look cool. And I'm sure they refer to when you're choosing what flower you can choose. Well, you know, this flower means something to my family, so I'm going to choose this one. But so often these things are just done because they're cool and they're fun. You know, sometimes it doesn't just go deeper than that.
Why would people wear swords? Well, to defend themselves and to, you know, defend their honor, and because they look cool.
So,
yeah, they're just cool.
I'd wear one if I could, but naturally we can't because we're not that kind of society.
Of course, like I know you might sound like a statement. Of course, you do have professionals,
of course,
who went to veteran as well, who went to fight schools. I don't want like the people to think that that's what we're saying.
Oh no,
you have examples already from the 15th century of professional soldiers.
Yeah.
That would get paid more if they had professional training done on learning how to use arms before they enlisted.
Yes, that's a very good point. Sorry, yes, I didn't mean to mislead there. I think that's a really good point. But again, it's not a secret thing. It's not that the society was secretly this way and we just don't know yet because we haven't done enough. Quite easily explainable reasons. It's, this is a profession. People need to train the profession. That's pretty much as far as it goes.
So, sadly, Mayer died not long after publishing
he died. He died 1571, we think around the age of 34, and it's quite interesting. In Dupuis' article, he talks about his death, and he mentions something I think is quite interesting, and I'm going to quote the article here. So in the article, Dupuis says, in a letter addressed to the Duke on the 24th of February 1571, his death was confirmed by a chancellor who complained about the lack of a physician at the court who could have saved them. Like, now, to me, that's quite interesting, because that to me implies something probably wasn't that bad of an illness, and it was probably something he could have survived. And Dupuis, in his article, in a footnote, says the original letters in Latin, and, you know, it would be worth looking into this a bit further. So we don't know tons about it, but I think that's quite an interesting point there.
Yeah, and he could have written more books.
Most importantly, yes.
just reminds me of that U.S. president. Was it James Garfield? I think it was James Garfield who was shot, but he did not die from the assassin's wounds. He died because of how the doctors examined him.
Oh, what?
Yeah. Anyway, I simply assumed that when Mayer...
You're right, it's Garfield, yeah.
It's fascinating to think that how one's life, that at least in our little universe of HEMA we consider so important, ended up so abruptly and so suddenly and so unnecessarily, really.
Mm-hmm.
So get your books out now and stop sitting on those manuscripts.
Talking about the written word, I'm just reminded of, I mean, obviously everyone's losing their minds because of all the pretty pictures in
and representation. We've got black people in there.
Yeah. The detail and the artwork is just sumptuous, but I'm just reminded of a meme I saw yesterday. It's that classic meme where there's a guy checking out another girl's behind and his girlfriend's mm-hmm. looking.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And I think it was published by Brisbane Swords. They have a lot of cool memes. And it was, you know, everyone's staring at the new Mayer book. Meanwhile, all these untranslated manuscripts or translated manuscripts that no one's interested in because they only want to look at pretty pictures.
I had a discussion on this yesterday. Again, like, maybe I'm a really angry man, I do not know, but
I didn't know.
Things like this, but I do get annoyed with, like, it's amazing looking at pictures, and my background is mainly that of an art historian, and I do love looking at art, but I find it amusing that sort of like the gateway drug to HEMA is really the pretty pictures, eh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, like, and we all love them. But in regards to when somebody tells me that, I do, when I hear things about German longsword and Lichtenau, when I hear about Führer, that their works that saw with such sparse information and people again fetishize over them because they have the space to produce wild interpretations based on minimum information, and they ignore like fine books that are very text heavy, not images.
I disagree there. I think that, only speaking from my own experience, and I might be wrong, what interested me, yes, was absolutely the pictures, but it wasn't that there was a loophole for me in that I didn't have to read text and learn how to do it. It's more just these pictures look cool. Oh, and look, there happens to be text. I think a lot of people coming into HEMA aren't aware that actually there are a lot of fight books that have much more text and explanation.
Oh, no,
they're
no,
just
no.
aware of these visual images, and that's a great way to get into it.
About people who come in, I'm talking about people who stay, and it seems they keep mm-hmm. only focusing on the images and mm-hmm. on things with minimum information. Mm-hmm. There's fight books with that are very text heavy, but very few people look compared to people looking things like Talhofer. Talhofer has nothing on it. Like, I mean, like, compared to the information that it contains, it's very little compared to the 3227A.
Yes, yeah, that's a really good point. And then I think that again sort of backs up your argument about how, you know, people need skills to be able to translate this. It's not just a case of looking at it and doing a bit of translation and sort of getting the idea. You need actually quite an arsenal of training and skills to be able to work out what's being said. So I think people like to go to the pictures because everyone can sort of read a picture and sort of roughly work out what's happening without having to do lots of heavy research.
Yeah, but the problem is that these pictures are treated as photographs. Mm-hmm. They're treated as evidence rather than supporting material. Mm. Like in the case of earlier books and the medium being, for example, the duel, mm-hmm. in my opinion, and not just mine, there's other academics who believe this as well, mm-hmm. the duel or like the bloody content in books, like again, like Hans Talhofer, uh-huh. to me is simply a commercial medium.
I think you're right on that. I think that's a really good point because I find it in a lot of larger accounts on HEMA, and I like when they do this. They'll show a picture of the manuscript and the illustration, and then they'll show, here's what it looks like in person. And it's a great way to sort of show the public, hey, look, it's not that complicated. It really is just people doing these moves. Here's how we translate. Becomes, no, this is exactly what he was trying to convey. That definitely can become quite difficult. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say that in the article by Dupuy, he mentions the possible Marozzo influence because on page 9 of his PDF, we got two images, one above the other. We got the Mayer's two gentlemen in colour with mm-hmm. wonderfully poofy pants. Standing mm-hmm. on a senyo, which is in a similar kind of arrangement to Marozzo's famous image of two gents in Guardia di Alincorno standing on a sort of solar looking senyo on the floor. Mm-hmm. I honestly prefer the hats to the poofy pants, but
no,
but then I'm biased, so Yes, and what do you make of the senyo and its sort of significance here?
I I'll go back to Olivier's article because he has covered a lot of it anyway, and it's not really my ideas, but he does mention how Pacheco later, he mentions how he considers Meyer a German translation or version of Marozzo.
Right.
Which is interesting because who knows if he had only extrapolated that from Meyer's manuscript or if he had actually seen the manuscript, right? We can we can only again like be like fanboys and fangirls and stipulate on that.
I mean, I've heard plenty of sort of bitter Bolognese fanboys and girls say that Meyer is just Bolognese with German names for everything.
I agree.
you agree?
you heard it here, folks.
I stand with the hats as well. I stand with the hats. I could not pull off the pants. I can pull off the hat.
Oh, for goodness sake. Right, write in what you think. We'll run a poll.
I like feathers. I like my feathers. And also, you know, like briefs, I don't know. Like, anyway.
Anyway.
I think that, again, there's a lot of discussion about plagiarism and if certain masters had seen the works of other masters and overlap. And somebody, like, I saw, like, this image going around where somebody has, like, this motion with a spear in the Meyer manuscript and then another book from the 18th century with a gun, I think. I don't even remember.
What, with a bayonet?
Yes, I think it was, yes, from the 18th century. Anyway, yeah. And there's a lot of discussion on that. And what I keep returning to, even on, like, and that applies even to the statement that Meyer is a German version of Marozzo, is that the human body and the human array of motions are finite.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, if you are martially savvy and you act in a specific manner in a specific context, there's only so many things you can do, and so it then goes down to the fencing master. How they're going to record that thing, that piece of information.
And then we
come after, you know, 400, 500 years with our audacity saying, nope, that's not what you meant, mate.
Yeah, I think that's a really, the topic of plagiarism is really, really interesting because I dislike it when people say, oh, in the past there was no such thing as plagiarism. Well, that's not completely true, but the more you get sort of towards 800 and onwards, more readers and writers sort of look towards originality as an important artistic value. Names began to be assigned to manuscripts more frequently. So there was definitely a build towards that wasn't as present in the medieval period. But, you know, during the medieval period, that exchange of ideas, you see it a lot in literature and a lot of it's really, really interesting because that exchange of ideas was so important to build on things like we do today. And there's so many academic papers, I don't know about the rest of you, but if ever I've gone to write a paper and I've come to a conclusion reading the primary source and I was like, okay, let's read more secondary work. And I'm like, damn it, someone had the idea in the 60s. Damn it, that now I look like I've stolen it. So you sort of know what I mean in that it's not plagiarism. You've just had the same idea. We're also assuming that Meyer's acting as if this is his own idea. And the idea that to present something and not cite is your own original idea is quite a modern concept. He might just be presenting this and saying, and here are my thoughts on it, but without saying where he's got it from. That doesn't mean he's necessarily presenting it as his own original idea.
Yeah, I mean, all the Bolognese masters, you say, this is this god, this is that god, and I came up with the name of this god. It's just like, well, this is just like the sort of collective wisdom, and this is how I use it. These are my take on it.
I think the other problem in this is that we read it today as readers, assuming that we have the same background as the people of these books were intended to, and people do tend to forget that we have neither the mindset nor the skill set nor the way of translating this internally and externally. We can try and do some interpretation, and I'm not talking about the motion here. I'm talking about like the pure mental part. We can try to understand what these things mean, but our understanding of this will always be our modern understanding.
I completely agree.
We are limited by the fact that we are born in the 20th century.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, if I give my kids a Walkman, they won't know what to do with it.
Yeah, it's. I think that's a really good point in that, you know, physically not much has changed, but there is definitely sort of cultural shorthands that we just simply are not privy to and might not have been recorded because they were so assumed as, well, clearly everyone knows what this is anyway, moving on. Yeah. So that's a really good point. I completely agree with that.
Let's talk about the actual content itself, like the sort of, I was looking at the content list here on page 10 of his article. So he's got a not insignificant amount of time pages devoted to Dussac and Rapier. Or rapier, as he called it, or side swords, or bolognese, as we really know it to be. And he then goes on to talk about dagger, staff, halberd, long pike, which has got a lot of people hot under the collar because there's 10 pictures on that.
Whoop, whoop.
And then there's the armoured combat at the end.
I'm so excited about that.
Elizabeth, tell us.
I'm afraid I have nothing academic to say about it at all. I'm just really excited to see, because you don't very often in fight books get the inclusion of armor as a concept. And I'm not surprised that it's more towards the end of it. You know, you do get some things on horses like in Fiore, but they're just a couple of mentions. So I'm excited to sort of add this to the few mentions that we do have, but nothing very clever or intelligent to say on it, I'm afraid.
It's exciting.
I'm just really excited.
Yeah, it's just the armored combat. Yeah. Whereas it's like the main dish in, like a core dish in the 15th century, like gets so sidelined in the 16th century that having this in the new manuscript and with these weird axe swords as well, nonetheless, which is the new toy that everybody wants, at Christmas. My money is like on Dave Rawlings being the first who gets one.
He always gets the best toys first.
He's like that kid in Christmas that he's like, oh, I got all of them. But he's lovely enough, he lets other people play with him, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
To me, that is a weird thing. And then completely not talking from a HEMA perspective, but rather from studying it as art genre. Like, I think, in my opinion, it has more to do with completion purposes, right? Mm-hmm. Like addressing subjects and materials that were more popular earlier. And maybe that's why he's not bothering covering more standard things in armor. And you know, like, of course, Dussac is like one of like the big things that we love from 16th century Germany, you know.
And I forgot to mention the two-handed sword. That's
like, oh yeah, that's important.
Do you know that? Do you know how awful is that? Because that's sort of one of my more favourite things. My eyes went straight to armoured combat, and then everything else went black.
I'm really happy you ignored like all the swords and you went straight for the staff weapons.
Yeah. Oh, shush.
I think it will be amazing. Like, I'm looking forward to further discussion. I'm hoping for more essays on APD. Maybe it's like some of the papers from that conference. Mm-hmm. I would like to see a comparison, like a deeper comparison between the manuscripts and the book, both linguistically, like doing like a comparison of the presentation of weapons, for example. And again, like, I think that's why we need people who have a knowledge both of like the more academic side of things, as well as the practical, to be able to translate certain things in a better manner, or rather translate the information better.
As an aside, it made me laugh when the Fiorists were like, and you laughed at our silly weapons, you know.
But you did! And continue to do so.
I have laughter saved for whenever anybody says it's a Fiorist.
Good. Yeah, that makes you look really nice and approachable, Yasin, doesn't it?
Nobody says I'm nice, more approachable. but my issues with Fiore, and like, again, like, inverted commas, furious is very, very different. Is about the amount of information. But like Mayer was already a trove of information, and now somehow this has exploded.
That's not fair.
I'm curious to know how it's going to change the sort of current interpretations of his work, having this extra, you know, insight.
I read a very interesting post again on Facebook, another thing from the Mayer feed.
Don't sound too enthusiastic. Yes.
Hey, like it's a good week, right? I was enthusiastic for the first 3 days.
And that's why we have to get things out quickly. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, we should have named this episode Meh.
No, nothing like that. Like, I'm genuinely excited about it.
You want something incendiary, sure.
But anyway, like the thing that I've seen, I think it was Matt Gallas who posted that, and he pointed out something quite interesting. It was that there's a page where Mayer breaks down the parts of the sword, and he breaks it down to three parts instead of four parts. I don't want to misquote him. Mm-hmm. And again, like it does take knowledge of somebody with a knowledge of the text, as well as somebody with a practical knowledge of somebody who has actually held a sword, to understand what that means. I did, like, it previously in public engagement event, trying to explain the whole thing, even about, you know, the strong and the weak part of the sword and all that. Mm-hmm. And you have the theoretical parts, but it's not until somebody touches a sword and sees like how the forces that can be applied on it interact at different parts of it. I think the applied knowledge of martial artists does have a place for sure in this field, and I do not think that we can do without it overall.
I agree. I think that's a good note to end on. Elizabeth, anything else you want to sort of add?
No, I'm just kidding. I echo Yasin's point. I'm very excited to see research that's coming out. I'm glad to see that sort of, you know, most people are sort of letting Dupuis and his team sort of break this down a bit more before jumping into it. And I'm just excited to see the comparison and what more it can tell us. And hopefully we won't lose it again.
Yeah, let's keep an eye on it.
Everyone watch all the other manuscripts. Has everyone got a location on all of them? Yeah. We should probably just do a roundup, do a head count, and then
just a big thank you to everyone who puts the times in bringing these things to us and making them accessible as well.
Yeah. But go check out Acta Periodica Dualatorum. It's an amazing, amazing journal. And I can't wait to hear what everyone else thinks about it.
Yeah, tell us your thoughts, folks. Thank you, Elizabeth and Yasin. It was lovely to have you on.
Oh, thank you for having us.
And thank you. And I look forward to chatting to you in the future about other exciting things.
Woo woo!
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To show your appreciation, please give us a 5-star review on your podcast platform, or support our work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/swordwomen. Go to @swordwomen on Instagram to see upcoming interviews, or visit buythesword.net to learn about our events, or visit our Facebook page, By the Sword. Our sponsor today is none other than our Patreon members. You folks are bringing swords and HEMA to listeners worldwide, so thank you. To support our work and receive exclusive benefits, visit patreon.com/swordwomen.